Hey, it's Mike Ness from Social Distortion. You're listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor. Walking the floor over you.
Hola, señores and señoritas. It is time for another edition of Walking the Floor with me, Chris Shiflett. Presented to you by Floyd's 99 Barbershops. Floyd's, come on in, America. Get your hair cut. First off, this week, what I need to do is wish my good old friend and fellow dead peasant and sometimes co-host of this very podcast you're listening to, Mr. Luke Tierney, a very, very happy birthday. He turned 44 years young last week. And we celebrated in high style by jamming some cover tunes up in Santa Barbara this past weekend at the Velvet Jones. And it was fiesta, and it was crazy, and I went to the rodeo, and it was just epic. But thank you, Luke, for throwing another epic party. It was good times. It was kind of like a high school reunion up there at Velvet Jones on Saturday night. It was like a high school reunion minus all the guilt I have about dropping out of high school. So hoorah for that. And this week I'm getting ready to leave again, hitting the road. But before we leave, I wanted to make sure I got this episode posted because this interview is really, really special to me. So let's jump right in with Mr. Mike Ness on Walking the Floor. All right, so a few months ago, I drove down to Orange County to interview Mike Ness, lead singer and guitarist for Fullerton punk rock legend Social Distortion at his amazing rehearsal space / Social D world headquarters, hidden in a nondescript industrial neighborhood deep behind the Orange Curtain. You'd never guess from the outside that this was Mike's place, but once you get inside, you're quickly swallowed up by vintage guitars, amps, clothes, stacks of vinyl records, movie posters, stereos, furniture, etc., etc. And although I've toured with Social D many times over the years in various bands and had met Mike many times before, this is the first time I'd ever sat down with him for a lengthy conversation one-on-one. And I admit, I was a bit nervous going in because Social D was such a huge influence on me growing up. From the time in high school that I first heard Telling Them pumping out of my best friend's car stereo, to the time I took the cover of one of their records with me to the barber shop to explain exactly how I wanted my hair cut, to how I dressed, to the guitars I played, to how I behaved at the bar, to, you get the idea. Anyway, I have to say that this was one of those rare times when it was actually really, really good to meet one of your heroes. So let's pick it up where Mike's explaining to me his interest in collecting vintage things on Walking the Floor.
So this place is amazing. It's like a Americana museum. Have you always collected vintage stuff?
I've been collecting for 30 years, yeah.
So all those years that, like, I would have imagined you out on tour being like punk rock, rebel, greaser dude, you were actually antiquing.
It was really once I got clean, you know, and just was able to have some hobbies.
Right.
And not all my money going to drugs.
When did you put this place together?
Almost 4 years ago. Well, I guess it was completed 3 years ago.
So. Right.
And it's just, I've just found that when I'm surrounded by the things I like, it inspires me to work.
Right.
I want to work. I want to come to work.
Right.
It's like, because this is like comfortable. And
right. So this is like, yeah. This is where you write. This is where you rehearse. This
exactly.
Where did you have all this stuff before you built this place? Like, was there a point for you where your wife was like, you got to get this fucking old shit out of our house?
Yeah. I mean, she likes old stuff, but she doesn't like clutter, you know? So
right.
Like, this would be, and our tastes are a little, I'm a little bit more like eclectic, I think.
Right.
Like crazy, just insane things and like clowns and just advertisement things and weird. So yeah, I basically just kind of had it in storage till I had the place to display it. And,
right. Like, yeah. what's a day in the life for you like now? Like, do you come here every day and
I should.
Do your thing and write?
I should. I guess a disciplined musician probably would, but
right.
Do you know any?
No. that's not part of the job description, generally.
It's like the two don't go together.
Right.
Right. No, sometimes there's months that go by I don't pick up a guitar, but
right.
I am trying to get a record written this year, so it's basically like setting one or two days a week
right.
to come here and just, you know, isolate and work.
Like at this point in your life and in your career, how do you decide when you're going to make a Social D album, go on tour, and go into work hustle mode?
Pretty much when I'm broke.
Really?
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
No, I mean, you know, we've always kind of had like large gaps in between records, and you know, it's not that it took like 8 years to write a record.
We right. just
I was raising a family at the time or doing whatever. So but you know, you don't want to take for granted that you can take a 5-year hiatus and assume that everyone's still going to be there waiting.
But at this point in your career, you kind of can take that for granted, I would think. It seems to me, you know, from being a fan of yours mm-hmm. all these years, that you've hit that point, or you hit it a long time ago, where there was never necessarily going to need to be an end to it. Like, seems like, I mean, that to me is like the ultimate success.
I think as long as the record is great,
right.
we're okay.
Right.
But I have to make sure it's a great record.
Right.
Yeah.
So do you write, like, are you one of those type of writers? I'm curious to, how your writing process mm-hmm. has evolved over the years. Like, in Another State of Mind, I think there's that footage of you working out that song, maybe, like, writing it right in that moment.
Acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
It's still how I write.
Really?
Yeah. It's really weird. It's just like, that hasn't changed. And the only difference is that... No, there is no difference, actually. I mean, I still write that way. The only difference now is like I can put the ideas on my cell phone. And,
right.
And then I do the same thing. I don't always know what the song is about when I'm writing it. It's really like 1 out of 10 where I've got the premise, the hook, and the melody all at once where I can just run with it. So like I'm working on a song right now and it's like, I have to go to my list of evocative titles that I've been accumulating over the last couple of years or ideas. And I scroll through that and it's like, oh, I wonder if that would work for this song. You know, does the syllables work? Does the theme work?
Do the chords sound? And the melody hit you first and then you get the others together?
Mm-hmm.
Do you write through the sort of peaks and valleys of inspiration, or do you just write all the time and wait till the good ideas hit you?
Well, one thing I noticed, and I talked about this in other interviews, in the past when we were recording a record and the record was done, I would kind of always shut the door on, it was like, okay, time to get into press mode, tour mode, it's on. Cycle, just tour cycle, the next 3 years of my life is going to be touring. So I would shut down the creative door and get into just work mode.
Mm-hmm.
And, but this time I realized that I didn't have to do that. So when we finished the last record, it was just like, well, let's just keep like, you know, writing down ideas, keep that door open, you know, because there's no reason why it has to stop when the record is done.
Sure.
So as a result of that, like now when it's time to write this record, I've got a bunch of ideas already. So it's a great starting point.
And that can be kind of daunting too, don't you think? That then that's like the real work. You have to go through and sift through it and
sure.
take this part from here and stick it over there.
Right.
And that whole, it's like a giant puzzle.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's just like, does this work or is this more like something I could use for the solo project or is
right.
this just like,
I mean, how do you decide if it's something for Social D and something for a solo project?
That's really hard sometimes. But in a way it's not, because the foundations of the song are almost the same. It's just kind of like, well, do I want to push it more roots and country? I'll go solo project. If I want to keep it pretty rocking and swinging, then I'll go with Social D.
Do you have any plans to do another solo record?
I do. Yeah, I actually have a lot of material for that.
Is it like your first couple solo records are kind of veering in a honky-tonk a lot? Like, have you ever been tempted to do just a full-on country record? Or is that your version of a full-on country record?
That's kind of my version, but I think I want the next one to be a little bit more refined Americana. You know, just singer-songwriter.
Like no big dynamics, no big guitars,
like label,
none of that stuff.
Of like rockabilly or country. Or
right.
No. It's all of that.
Right.
You know, but just singer-songwriter.
Sure.
You know, so not have any limitations or not. Because I just don't like limitations. That's why I went and did the solo thing, because I sometimes felt limited with Social D, but...
Like there was an expectation on
well, you couldn't
what you could
bring
do.
In banjos and fiddles and right. stuff with Social D. People would probably bum out, you know.
Right.
Yeah, so.
Who are the honky tonk artists that resonate the most with you? Like, who are your guys in that?
Well, my top ones are George Jones and Hank Williams. Yeah.
What about the Bakersfield guys? I noticed you had a song called Bakersfield
Buck
on your
Owens,
last record.
Sure.
Merle Haggard.
Yeah, I mean, Buck Owens, I feel really, you know, brought this weird element of rock to country.
Sure. And some of that early stuff. And George Jones, too, like a lot of those guys in that era.
Yeah.
Were almost, it's like almost rockabilly. It pretty much is
well,
rockabilly.
Well, George Jones was in his early years. It was Thumper Jones.
I just read this book on Farron Young, and they were talking about how in the late 50s when rock and roll first hit that that it kind of killed country for a little bit. Like the people that would have been listening to, you know, Hank Williams or not Hank Williams because he was dead, but Buck Owens and people like that were listening to Elvis. And I thought that was such a strange thing that they're so close. They're like cousins.
Yeah, I mean, they just probably couldn't see the connection. I mean, it was a natural evolution, you know, of country and black R&B and being mixed and rock and roll being born, really. I mean, through rockabilly and through, you know, I also like the artists who just, you know, Chuck Berry was like everything.
Sure.
You know, he could do a country folk or just straight up rock and roll.
Have you ever gotten any feedback over the years from some of your heroes of country music? Have they ever heard your versions of their songs?
Oh, I mean, when I was recording White Light, White Heat in Hollywood, you know, Johnny Cash was in the room next door recording.
Really?
And I went over there to get an autograph, you know, I mean, I had to make it quick. He's eating dinner watching some gospel guy on TV, and but I said, yeah, we're the guys who covered Ring of Fire, and he's like, yeah, I heard.
Was he aware of that? Had he heard?
Yeah, he was. It was really cool.
Wow.
You know, other than autographs that I've gotten from him, you know, I've never really like, hey, you know, like, do you like my stuff too?
It'd be good to put him on the spot, though.
Yeah, I'd be like,
what's your favorite Social D song?
Exactly.
Buck Owens.
Yeah.
Just on a different subject, I heard that you were writing an autobiography a while back, and then I heard that you decided not to write an autobiography. Why? Or is that true?
It was true. I got basically done with it. I mean, well, the rough draft was done.
Right.
And I was trying to take a year off because I've been pretty much working the last 10 years and just realized that the year off wasn't going to be a year off. I was writing the book was really a lot of work. And I mean, I didn't go to college or anything, but I would equate it to like, you know, having to write a major essay or paper for your most serious class. Only I had to write 33 of them, 33 chapters. And so I just decided to just postpone it. I have the rough draft is sitting right over there.
Really?
And
I might have to wind up in my backpack on the way out the door.
Yeah. You know, it's something I definitely want to do, and was almost like considering maybe like trying to finish it this year, but I think a record's more important right now. So
did you keep journals through the years? Because I think about if I wanted to write my autobiography, I don't really remember most of it.
No, I didn't. I had to have some like helpers, like ghostwriters. Kind of, they were more like fact finders.
Right.
So they would interview my mom and say, "Hey, you know," and interview friends.
Like, here's Mike's version of this. What's your version of this?
Yeah, or just, you know, I mean, I kind of shut down already by the age of 5. You know, I was in a very dysfunctional home, so I kind of that's when I found music and fantasy and everything, and just kind of went to my own world. So it was interesting to see, you know, from them, you know, what was going on, and there was a whole lot of crazy shit going on, you know.
Right.
So, but it make, you know, it's my story, and I believe that, you know, a lot of people want to hear it. But I mean, it was sometimes very uncomfortable and painful, and
sure,
you know, but also, I wanted to write kind of like a tragic comedy too, you know, that where there's tragedy, but then it's like, yeah, but look, I got a good sense of humor out of it, or
right,
you know, or just the irony of things, or just things that just people had no idea, you know, yeah.
Well, you know, you look around this place, and anybody that knows you like can see that you have a deep appreciation of the past and culture from the past.
I have a sensitive side.
You have a sensitive side. But I was wondering if, you know, maybe you don't have that obsession with your own past. You seem like a guy that moves forward in your own life, in your own work. But I'm wondering if maybe going through and trying to write your autobiography was like maybe just an uncomfortable experience.
It was, but it also was aligning it with everything I was going through at the time and still am. So, you know, I think things happen when they're supposed to. And, you know, I think that when it is time to write the book, to finalize it, I will have, you know, kind of gotten to another point in my life. And by being at that other point, we'll be able to be reflective clearly and be able to articulate what I want to say better, I think, yeah.
I mean, how often do you revisit your older records? Do you listen to them much? Like, is there
not,
stuff
no,
on those
No, not
early
very
records?
Much, but like, right, say right now, like where I'm getting ready to write a record, it's important to listen to some of that stuff for production value, like you and I were talking about earlier. Like, I noticed that Somewhere Between Heaven and Hell and the self-titled, those were Dave Jordan productions, and they have a great overhead on them. Well, we were talking about that. How do you get that, keep that overhead, you know, space and air in your recordings when you got two guitars just blazing at 10?
Right.
And I was listening to those records, and they are a pretty good example of that. So for that, and then like we did this, the touring that we're doing this year is going to be, we're playing this record in its entirety, which we started on New Year's Eve. And it was like playing the record in its entirety was like, it really like, oh God, I really kind of forgot about this song, or I forgot about this period in my life, or I forgot about like, you know, this approach to songwriting. So it's good to, you know, go back from time to time, but I don't listen to my own music very much.
Obviously, you've been making records for a long time. Are there songs from your early records that you listen to now that you go, oh God, that just make you uncomfortable, that make you cringe a little bit?
Of course, yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, because I mean, back then, you know, like when you had 10 songs, you just went in the studio and recorded them. You didn't like get to sit with them for a few months and see if like, is this just a good idea? Is this a good idea or a bad idea? So I've learned now that if you're going to record a record with 10 songs on it, you better write 20.
Right. Don't you always wish that you could go tour a record before you make it?
see if people like it.
Right.
Well, we kind of do that. I mean, I'm the first who wants to play a new song, even if I haven't even finished it. I'll just be like, mumbling words, and I may have the catchphrase, but
right.
The rest I'm just kind of mumbling.
People winging it.
People don't notice.
People can't tell anything can't in a room. Tell. You got to really blow it in a gig
really
for people
blow
to notice.
It. Yeah. So, but we've always kind of done that. So then the songs are already like familiar when the record comes out.
What are your, to go way back, what are your earliest musical memories? Like what got you into music? What drew you to it?
Well, I'd say, like I told you, when I was at age five, I think that, you know, there was a lot of stuff going on in the home, and I found like some sort of safety or some sort of like escape, you know, basically when I could go into a room, and this particular room, like I talked about this in the book, you know, we had this elderly babysitter and we were left with her for long periods of time. And she had a spare bedroom with like, and this is an old house in Fullerton and an old Grove house. And she had this room with like a hi-fi in there and then all this like, you know, Renaissance kind of religious, you know, like religious art that has like nudity and, you know, so it's like right. Nudity and Christ is all bloody.
It's like you're getting all your things are firing all wrong inside. You're
right,
getting everything
right.
Mixed
and then
up.
The guitar and the radio, and it was just like, oh, this is like sex, rock and roll. Like,
Jesus.
This is like Jesus. Like I don't need anything else. This is it right here. And I was at age 5 years old.
Really?
I mean, I remember it like it was yesterday.
And what records did she have? Like, what were you listening
to?
Well,
I think it was probably radio at the time. So it was like probably, you know, this probably would have been 1967. So he probably had everything from Creedence Clearwater to Sam and Dave mm-hmm. to the Beatles, the Stones. And it just, you know, it just left an impression on me. And I just knew at that age that, you know, this is making me really feel good. Yeah.
And when did you start actually playing guitar?
Probably about 10 or 11. Yeah.
And so when did you, like, what were you like as a kid? Because it's kind of a big leap to go from playing some Creedence songs in your room to fronting mm-hmm. a punk rock band.
Mm-hmm.
Like, were you like an extrovert? Were you the kid that was jumping up on the table at your parents' parties and singing Hank Williams songs?
No.
How did you make that leap?
No, I was kind of, well, I guess it kind of started, I mean, I was a weird kid, man, you know? I mean, you know, I felt this need to seek attention, but it wasn't like in an extroverted way. It was kind of like I became the classroom clown. Kind of, you know, and even that negative, it was negative attention from the teacher, but if I could get a laugh from the kids, so.
You were playing to the room.
Exactly. So right. I was like in fourth grade, you know, we still had like projectors and we're showing a film. And if you had a question, you know, you raise your hand. So I would like, we're watching something on like Lincoln or something. And I would raise my hand and I'd say, why is the sky blue?
See, that's the best kind of way to fuck with your teacher, because
I think it's hilarious.
They can't really get mad at you.
But I know, but he fucking got pissed, man. I mean, one time he took me out of the class and shook the living shit out of me. I mean, you know, he didn't appreciate the humor.
Right.
But, you know, that negative attention, you know, I really... and then, you know, I'd grown up kind of, my uncles were, you know, kind of greaser, hippie kind of guys. So, you know, the tail end of the hippie counterculture. So it was like, you know, I was really exposed to a lot of that, you know, counterculture stuff. So, you know, I kind of, instead of, you know, I grew up across the street from this park that had a little league and Pop Warner, but... You know, I didn't have parents that were encouraging me to play sports. So, you know, I saw Easy Rider and I grew my hair out and made a chopper bike and I'd cruise the park and try and hit on the sisters or of the baseball players playing Little League, yeah.
Right.
Just like, hey, look at me. I'm on a chopper. I got long hair. I got bell-bottom jeans. And
I mean, do you see some of those traits in your own kids? Like, how's that being a dad and sort of dealing with watching your kids sort of, you know, have some of your darker impulses, I guess?
Yeah, well...
Is that there?
Yeah, for sure. And it's... well, it was concerning at some point,
right.
But now it's kind of, you know, we made it through any hard times, and
right.
Now we're...
How old are your kids?
23 and 19.
Oh, so you've got, yeah. Your kids are adults.
Yeah, yeah, technically.
Right.
Yeah, no, you know, it's all part of it, you know, it's all part of the, just, you know, learning, and still learning kind of, how to be a parent,
right?
Like, even though they're grown.
Do you ever struggle with that? Like the sort of what your life has become versus where you started out? Like, I'm wondering if maybe your sort of younger nihilistic self pops up at inopportune moments in your life these days, especially with parenting.
Yeah, well, definitely has in the past. When I became a parent, I thought really, it's probably a common misconception is like, well, how hard can it be, you know?
Right.
And just diapers and bottles and, you know. But I was writing in the book basically how unequipped I was. And so, I mean, it's been a learning curve. And like I said, I'm still kind of learning and kind of correcting mistakes from the past, whether it was like, did we spoil them? Now do we have to like try and reverse that? Did we, you
know, that's something I would love to understand. Yeah. How do you unspoil your kids?
You make them do chores and you make them wait and earn their money and learn the value of a dollar, which is what I didn't do.
Right.
You know, but you know, they still need me, and it's, very apparent that they do, and I'm at a great point of like learning right now. So when I do, you know, anger was a big thing for me, when something was happening at home, it was triggering something from my past, and it took me a long time to ever you know, want to look at the past, let alone go and try and, you know, get help to kind of walk through it and process it and kind of heal from it. So that's happening now. And I'm starting to see like, oh, you know, this is happening right now. This is making me feel like this right now, but there's two different things happening. And I don't have to act on the one that's giving me this visceral, physical, like, you know, thing. I can separate them, and maybe I got to walk away for an hour and process that and then deal with it. But
it's hard to do.
It is. And, you know, like I said, I was really unequipped. I grew up in a, you know, very dysfunctional home. So, you know, it's all about getting tools to put in your toolbox, you know. Mm-hmm.
And do your kids get what you do? Like, do they understand who you are, sort of like in terms of like being an iconic cultural figure? Do they get that whole side of it?
Yeah, and they're, you know, it's funny because it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You'll see when your kids are teenagers. It doesn't matter what you do for a living. Like, you're not going to be cool.
Right.
You know, like, you might as well just be a plumber, you know, and you're just dad.
Yeah.
And then as they got a little bit older, they started to, you know, just appreciate how hard that I work and to provide, and that it's not, that it is work.
Sure.
It's not just people think sometimes that our job is really easy because we get to do what we love. But it is a lot of work, as you know.
Sure. Yeah, try to convince anybody of that.
Right. Because it's their Friday night. They've already worked for 40 hours.
Right.
It's now it's their time to have fun. So they think that you're there to have fun too. But, right. Which you are, but you're working.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's go back a little bit. Like, what was your entry point into punk rock? What was the scene like in Orange County when you were growing up? Because in my imagination, mm-hmm. it was like Orange Groves and right-wing cops and stuff. Like, what was happening around you that got you into it?
Well, okay, so I was listening to the music when I was five, starting at five, and, you know, it kind of, what I was listening to kind of progressed. So it started with the Beatles and the Stones and by seventh grade, I'm listening to Lou Reed Transformer, you know, mm-hmm. learning about heroin and transvestites. And so, and David Bowie. And so it was like, for me, it was just a natural progression to go from that glitter to the punk. You know, it was almost kind of like, you know, I was always kind of, being a guitar guy, you know, wanting, at the time Led Zeppelin was doing it, but then at the time, then it was this, then it was like, when I heard the Pistols and the Ramones, it was like, that's it.
Right.
That's it right there. Like,
but were there local bands around you that were like, who were the local bands?
Yeah. Well, when I was 17, when we were starting the band, Dennis and I used to go and watch a local band in Fullerton called The Mechanics. And these guys were like, kind of like an MC5, Iggy and the Stooges.
Right.
They dressed
like
up
garage rock kind of.
Yeah, they literally, like, they dressed up in mechanic, greasy mechanics clothes. They drank beer out of quart oil cans. They were playing our high school kegger parties, and the singer would come out and say, hey, you know, we're in The Mechanics, and we don't play any fucking slow songs. Ching, 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 you know? So it was this fucking angst, you know, and locally. Yeah. And by then, you know, Dennis's brother, older brother, worked as a lighting guy at the Starwood. So we were like going to Hollywood on Tuesday nights and, you know, we're underage, getting in free at the Starwood and seeing, like, you know, Fear and the Blasters play and the Germs. And so, I mean, it was a fabulous period of time to be young and to be just like a sponge, you know. But it was also 1979 in Orange County and very, you know, conservative. And so it was a very, it wasn't like, you know, I wrote about this in the book also. It wasn't like, you know, the guys in X and all of them, they lived in Hollywood or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, well, it's acceptable for freaks. And, you know, chances are you could walk down Hollywood Boulevard and a carload of jocks or rednecks isn't going to scream out, hey, faggot, or whatever.
Yeah.
Which was our case. And then you flip them off and they turn around and right. you get it on. And that's what it was like. It was a very hostile environment for people didn't want to see change. They didn't, you know, punk was
like...
They were
threatened by it.
They were. It was like punk was bringing, you know, rock and roll back into the clubs and theaters, out of the stadiums back into the clubs, and you know, people wanted to go to Cal Jam or whatever.
They didn't, yeah, yeah.
You know, they didn't want to. Yeah, it was just like, yeah, you fucking listen to that fucking Devo shit, man. You fucking Devo fags. Or, you know, and it's just right. so fucking ignorant.
Right.
You know, but it was like, you know, that just fueled it. I mean, it really did. So, you know, I was 17. I was pissed. And that was my outlet. And I needed a voice.
So that probably helped you.
It really
probably
did, because you know, I wasn't allowed a voice in the home. So, you know, that gave me my voice, and you didn't have to be a six-year music grad. Mm-hmm. You just needed the courage to get up there on the stage and say what you wanted to say. And
do you ever think about how far culture has shifted since that time? I mean, you have a mural on the wall at Floyd's barbershop here in town. Mm-hmm. Like, do you ever think about that? Like, how, like, you know, in 1979, say, when mm-hmm. your band was starting out, there weren't business owners or corporations or whatever celebrating your achievements. No. And now there's, like, you know, professional athletes covered in tattoos with green mohawks.
Yeah, there was no major labels that knocking must be like, at our door.
Right. Or anybody.
Or
you know?
No licensing people, nothing. No.
Right.
As a matter of fact, you know, back then, if you wanted to make a record, you just paid for it yourself and you put it out yourself.
Right.
And you sell it out of the trunk of your car.
Is that how you did Mommy's Little Monster?
Yeah. That's how we did our first few singles. Well, our first single, you know, we were approached by Posh Boy Records to do that because he came to a party that we were playing at and there was 400 punks in Huntington Beach. And the cops came and it was a big, you know, buzz. So he decided to make a 45 with three song EP with us. And that was the beginning of it. That was 1980.
Was there a point where you went, rock and roll is going to be my life mm-hmm. forever and that's just what it's mm-hmm. going
to
be?
Well, yeah, I mean, in answer to that, yes. I mean, we were living fast at that time at 18 years old. Didn't really foresee making it to 30. Frankly, you know, is live fast, die young, leave a pretty corpse. And in other words, it was such a lifestyle and it was self-destruction and it was...
Like, was it ambitious and competitive between the, you know, bands and your peers
Well,
at the
for
time?
Me, okay, so at the same time, I had this kind of push-pull thing where, you know, you have this self-destructive lifestyle, but also, you know, I wanted to become successful. Like, I wanted, and I didn't just want to play in front of punk rockers. Our crowds were always very mixed back then. And if I could convert you, someone maybe who wasn't a punk, to like Social Distortion, then it was like, cool. See, we're, because everyone was telling us that back then that this was shit.
Right.
And I was looking at bands like The Clash, you know, going to see them. They had roadies and tour bus and, you know, that's what I wanted. I wanted to be a rock star.
Right.
You know, regardless of the stigma that, you know, for a while there was like you weren't supposed to become successful or something if you were in punk. It's like, bullshit, man.
I mean, you guys were like one of the first bands to get a major label record deal.
Yeah, and I remember getting slack for it, too. I mean, I remember, like, we pulled up in a tour bus, and some fans go, oh, you fucking, yeah, well, you want me to be in the fucking stinky van with fucking eight guys still?
Like, I've done that enough.
Like, come on, like, I pay my fucking dues, man. You know, so I just never bought into that.
Right.
That was a very small percentage of people who felt that way anyways.
Sure.
And then, you know, by 5 years in to our career, which the first 5 years was just a big party. I mean, we did a few things right, apparently, but 5 years in, I got clean and just realized that, like, wow, man, you know, I'm in a pretty good position right now to, I mean, we weren't making any real money or anything back then, but it's like, if I want to do this, I'm going to have to, you know, get serious about it. And I had all this energy now because I wasn't out having to commit crimes and score dope anymore. So it's amazing how much energy you have once you stop that shit. And so I just, like, got this work ethic out of nowhere and just had tunnel vision.
Have you managed to stay clean like ever since then?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a long time.
I mean, it took a couple years of messing up.
Right.
But yeah, so, but by October 85, I kind of landed and was done. I mean, I was done. I mean, yeah. I think a lot of it, what helped me kind of hit my bottom sooner was because of the painful childhood. Mm-hmm. So being alone on the streets of Santa Ana just really was like intensified. And it was like, man, I don't want to live my adult life in pain too. You know, childhood was already painful enough. So, you know, it just kind of helped me, I think, hit bottom a little quicker.
Let's totally shift gears and talk about something more fun. I was watching this video of you online where you're boxing, you're training. Yeah. Uh-huh. And I noticed when I pulled in here that there's a gym right next door. Is that like just good luck or is that your place?
I used to train there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Now I train down south, but
I'm a boxing fanatic myself.
Are you really?
So I'm just wondering, you know, what
it's just something that I, you know, well, when I was a kid, I did martial arts. You know, we were talking earlier, my idols when I was a kid were not really athletes and presidents. They were like junky guitar players. And I had like, so I had Keith Richards and Bruce Lee and John Dillinger. Like, those were like on posters in my room, you know. And so I did martial arts when I was a kid, but boxing, I just fell into. I tried it in the 90s and didn't really commit to it. I didn't get very good at it. And then about 6 years ago, I started, and I had this common misconception of like, you know, I had to fight as a teenager, you know. Mm-hmm. And when I was a 17-year-old punk rocker, it seemed like the people I was fighting weren't other 17-year-olds. They were like 25-year-old grown men or even 35-year-old grown men who were just fucking aggro by my presence. And so I had to learn how to fight, you know. And but I just thought that, you know, how hard could boxing be, you know?
Right.
You know, it's just, so I did it for 2 years next door and, you know, would spar with a pretty big guy, but he kind of lumbered.
Right.
You know, so I was able to get inside and land stuff until he would get tired of getting hit, and then he would just throw a gnarly body shot and just drop me.
People don't understand how bad that hurt. That's worse than getting punched in the face.
Oh, my God. 10 times. I mean, yeah. So, I would spar with other people, and it's like, God, I could kill this guy in a fight. Like, why is he landing punches and I'm not? And I just realized, you know, I'd spent 2 years just like kind of still barroom brawling.
Right.
And then I went to Europe and trained for a summer. And then I really got convinced. It's like, I have not spent enough time on the basic fundamentals. So I just stopped and started over.
Really?
I went right back to the very beginning.
Where did you go in Europe to train?
Everywhere, every country I went to just...
Like on tour?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
During the days. And that's so fun because, I mean, every gym I went into, you walk out with just something different.
Sure.
And my favorite was Manchester. I mean, it's just the white ghetto. And fucking everyone thinks British are like kind of like prim and proper, but
not in Manchester.
dirty fucking birds. And it was really cool. So after that, then I started over with a friend of mine who's a trainer, and it's been like 2.5 years, and it's just changed the whole game. And
you ever do any white collar fights? You ever get into any of that?
What's that?
The white collar fights. You ever do a white collar fight?
I don't know what that is.
Like it's like you know, it's like amateur fights.
No, but I could see myself doing it. I mean, I would do it. Yeah, for sure. Especially if I could figure out a way to like base it like a fundraiser or a charity or something around it.
I got a good opponent for you.
Yeah, who?
Bob Dylan. Okay. Boxing fanatic.
I know.
He does the same thing. He travels around. We opened some shows for him, and his bass player was telling me that they go to gyms all over. Yeah. I think you could take him.
I'd be willing to. I'd be willing to take that card.
All right. Let's see if we can set that up, guys. We'll televise. It's going to be huge.
Yeah, but no, I just, you know, I was watching MMA for a while, and I just don't have the same appreciation as I do for boxing because, you know, boxing is just so the science behind
it. Sweet science.
And it's just, I just love it, and it just really, you know, it makes my life easier. You know, I'm so much happier when I'm doing it.
It's like therapy. A good trainer is like your therapist.
My workout is 2.5 hours. And so I get done with that and it's just like, all right, I'm ready for the day. The hardest part of my day is over.
Right.
You know, and it just, it does. It releases all the stuff in my brain and body that I need. And well, I just love it. Yeah, I mean.
Do you ever get out to the fights? Like, do you follow? Like, who are your favorite guys?
Well, I like the Mexican, you know, fighters, Alvarez.
Left hook to the liver.
Yeah, just, you know, just their warrior, you know, mentality.
Well, are you a Pacquiao or Mayweather? I picture you more as a Pacquiao guy.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I guess they have to milk the ego and the arrogance side of it to, you know, that helps sell tickets. Yeah. But it's, for me, it's a turn off.
Yeah,
in a big way. Mayweather get the shit knocked out of him. Yeah,
wouldn't that be amazing? By the time this thing is out to the world, we will know whether or not that fight's ever going to happen because it looks like it's already past the deadline again. Who do you think wins that fight? You could seem like, you know, well, real. You know, you're looking in the crystal ball here.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to see Pacquiao just take that. Yeah. I'd love to see it.
Yeah, that would be. That's what I'm hoping. My own sense is that he is more shot than Mayweather. Like he has more mileage on him. That's why I'm so afraid that fight's going to happen. Because then everybody that always said Mayweather would win, if he does win, is going to go, see, I told you. But in 2009, I don't think he wins that fight, Mayweather. I think Pacquiao walks through him.
Yeah, it's funny because I got invited to the Vegas fight with Mayweather and the Argentinian.
Oh, with Maidana.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I was friends with the promoter who was best friends with the manager. So he called me up, do you want to come? And go, yeah. And I was like this far from, you know, and, you know, I was with all the Argentinians. And it's like, come on, please, please. And he lost the fight, but I have very good sources that were with the press the next day and said Mayweather couldn't even walk.
Oh, yeah.
He was beat up. His body was beat up.
Yeah.
You know, and Maidana put pressure on him that he hadn't had put on him.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think Pacquiao can do it, you know?
I hope so. Well, I just hope they make that fight and get it over with.
Yes, please.
That is pretty much everything that I wanted to ask you. Oh yeah, I saw some footage. It was, I think, in that same clip. I saw some footage of you riding around on a tractor. Do you do you have a farm or something somewhere?
I have a small property up north. That's a getaway. It's like a small house on 3 flat acres, and yeah, I have to learn to.
Do you grow crops and stuff?
Not yet.
I started a garden this past summer, but that's like you're taking it to a whole other level.
No, I mean my wife does that, and. It's amazing. I mean, I went out today and cut 20 lemons off of a tree, and I'm going to go give them to a friend, and it's just like, this is so rad to have, be like, you know, growing organically and just having it and just producing oxygen in the air and bees, and I really enjoy that. And someday, yeah, right now I just have to maintain the field, but someday... You know, I was a city slicker, and I came in, and you know, I had to like meet the neighbors. I had to build this fence, and you know, I had to learn all this. I had to ride the tractor, and I had to learn all that. But I gained the respect, and someday, yeah, we'll have like a small organic orchard there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah,
that's
I really enjoy just working with my hands and being out in the dirt and sun and just contributing to the ecosystem. And I'm an environmentalist, so
sure.
It really, it's important to me.
I mean, I was going to ask you, like, what's something about you that totally contradicts how you're perceived by the public, but it sounds like you may have just answered it.
There's all kinds, yeah. I mean, I enjoy yoga. I am an animal rights activist. I'm an activist. I mean, right. It's like you're either active or you're non-active.
Right. You're engaged.
Right. So always trying to, like, listen to alternative radio and get alternative news and try and get the facts, you know, not what... I was just thinking at breakfast, I was watching the news, and the newscaster's name is Wolf Blitzer. It's like, is that a made-up name for a biased to get a... It's almost, it already almost, like, creates a... Yeah,
right.
Wolf Blitzer,
yeah.
We're gonna get him blitz. Let's just blow up that country, Wolf. Huh?
Something tells me that's not by accident.
It's not, right?
Yeah.
It's just so it's those types of things that just really insult my intelligence and really just like, come on.
That's the thing that I never understand about people that sort of take mainstream media at face value is it's always I'm a high school dropout. I'm no smarter than anybody else. Mm-hmm. But it has always seemed just obviously false. And you don't have to be a genius to figure that out.
You don't. You just have to, have to be able to read between the lines.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, there's some other sides to me that people may not realize, but yeah.
So I guess last question. What's next? What are you doing now?
Well, the plan is to do a little touring this year, but really just concentrate on writing a record, getting in the studio and recording.
When do you think that'll be out there for people?
My goal would be to be in the studio at the end of the year, to be recording.
Right.
Which would be nice, yeah.
Get it out next year sometime.
2016, beginning of the year or spring.
Cool. Yeah. I'll look forward to it. Thank you.
And then what about this thing? Like, is anyone going to interview you? Because I think I'd be a good,
When you want to do the sequel to this interview and turn the tables around, you can ask me the uncomfortable, hard questions.
Because I think the fans are gonna, who are watching this are going to want to know.
I'm ready. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I will give you these.
Okay.
And you can just ask me the exact... It might be a little weird when you're asking me about Orange County punk rock in 1979, but I'll make some shit up.
Yeah, because where are you from?
Santa Barbara.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. I've told you this before. I don't know if you remember, because I'm sure you get told this all the time, but my band opened for you guys up in Santa Barbara when it was when you were touring your self-titled record.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was our first class.
Yeah,
that was the first tour we got a bus on.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was not. It wasn't.
We didn't make fun of you for having a bus. I promise you.
I know you didn't. but I remember the bus. It was an old clunker, no air conditioning, but we were just stoked to have a bus.
Oh, it's the best. Yeah. I remember the first bus I was on. The guy, the bus driver, was so mean. And I didn't know theoretically sort of worked for you. Yeah, and he would take I would leave my shoes out, and he would take them and hide them.
Oh, God.
And so every morning I kind of get out of my bunk like, where are my fucking shoes?
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Should have hit his Mountain Dew.
Should have done something. Thanks a million for doing this, Dan. I really appreciate it.
It's fun.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, you heard him. Mike Ness said he was going to interview me sometime. And we are going to hold him to that if we can. God, what a great interview. I just want to listen to that over and over again. What a great guy. So cool. And we learned new stuff about him. We learned that Mike Ness might someday become an organic farmer somewhere in California riding a tractor. I love it. I love it when you talk to somebody like that and there's just all this great stuff you didn't know about them and always wanted to ask them. And that's what I love about doing this podcast. It's exactly what we did in that interview right there. Anyway, check out socialdistortion.com. I think that they are out on the road right now. And also, while you're at it, check out the newly redone walkingthefloor.com website, which is all pretty looking now with all the interviews up, all organized, all nicely for your listening pleasure. All right, I'll be back in a couple of weeks. See you out on the road somewhere. Adios, amigos! Stick it in the back of the police rock. Short hair, we'll have to